Our next case for argument this morning is the CFTC against Zellner.
May it please the Court. My name is Kirk Manhart. I represent the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. This Court should reverse the District Court's dismissal of the CFTC's complaint for lack of jurisdiction.
If you would raise your voice a little, I think that would help us.
Yes, Your Honor. The District Court erred when it held that Aileron FX contracts are spot contracts rather than futures contracts subject to regulation under the Commodity Exchange Act. A spot contract is a current contract for immediate purchase or near-term delivery of something. A standard, typical example of a spot contract for a currency would be the currency exchange at the airport. One takes $10 and receives $10 of some other currency in return. In contrast, a futures contract is a contract with a focus upon price speculation, a contract for the future delivery, for a contract for a price set now for delivery at a certain time in the future.
You know, before you go further, and forgive me, Mr. Manhart, but I have a housekeeping question, because you asked for remand for discovery. Were you prevented from engaging in discovery by the District Court?
There was an issue below. The government moved for reconsideration following the issue of the memorandum opinion, asserting that the commission was not permitted full discovery, for it didn't fully comprehend that the jurisdictional issue was to be decided upon this record.
What I'm trying to figure out is what you could learn through discovery that would change the nature of these transactions.
Well, let me first state our primary position here is we seek reversal, and we believe the record is fully adequate and perfectly appropriate for entertainment of that position. We don't believe we need discovery to establish our position. However, before we were to lose, we did assert we have a right to explore the nature of the transaction. That is, there is an affidavit from Mr. Ramon, the managing director of Aileron FX, describing certain aspects of the transaction. And on that basis, we know that delivery was never requested, never occurred in these transactions. There are other issues in the record concerning the mechanics of these trades. How many, under the terms of the contract, for example, the minimum increment was $100,000. Yet individuals traded these contracts and opened up the accounts. They traded multiple contracts where their total investment was in the range of $5,000.
But how were you prevented from engaging in that kind of discovery by the District Court?
The Commission had understood that the District Court had accepted the agreement between certain of the defendants and the Commission that the jurisdictional issue was to be deferred. And on the eve of the preliminary injunction hearing, one of the other parties asserted in full form the jurisdictional question, and the Court entertained it. And
I take it then that your answer to my colleague is no, you weren't prevented from engaging in any discovery you wanted to engage in.
No, I don't believe that we were at that time. It was a question of comprehension of the notice provided by the District Court. But our prime position, as we've asserted, is that the District Court erred on the record in existence, and we don't need discovery to establish that, and we don't need discovery for this Court to fully review the decision of the District Court.
Let me ask you what is my main question. Is in what sense are these contracts fungible, tradable instruments?
They are fungible and tradable because Aileron contractually bound itself to match any order and to provide a closing position for every open position.
And
so they were fungible.
Do you think people were trading the contract?
Not one-to-one between customers. customers. They were trading the contract with Aileron as the counterparty to every transaction.
Look,
Aileron serving, excuse me,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to finish my thought.
Sure.
Aileron serving as the house, standing as the opposite side, propounding bid and ask prices and accepting them so that such that a customer could trade in and out of a contract and routinely did, as this record
does. Maybe my question is not clear. When I say fungible contract, I mean the way it was discussed in the Nagel case, which you don't really want to engage in your brief. But in the Nagel case, we talked about fungible, tradable contracts as a defined contract, you know, 100,000 pork bellies, which people then trade, or 50 bushels of red number 2 wheat delivered Chicago. Right, those are understood futures contracts. Is there anything like that here?
The contract defines the minimum increments of the contract as $100,000 and then set, allows the customer to, and then Aileron propounded bid and ask prices it would take the opposite side of.
That's what it sounded like. It sounds like what you're describing is unique transactions between Aileron and each investor. They were all different. They were different sizes. They were different times. They had different expiration dates. They are not anything that could have been traded on the Board of Trade.
No, but that uniformity is a function of traditional on-exchange trading. It is not uniformity.
Then you run into the problem that we held in Nagel, that something that can't be traded on the Chicago Board of Trade is not a futures contract.
I believe that this court's holding in Nagel was that question of fungibility is different, relying upon the Copetro decision in the Ninth Circuit, where a contract has offset. That these are fungible in the sense that they are fully tradable for speculative purposes by the customer who entertains them. The argument, in all due deference, that the court suggests would mean that there can be no futures contract.
Respectfully.
Yes, Your Honor. My apologies.
It means all the deference due.
Yes, Your Honor. That every boiler room or off exchange where essentially the entity, the corporation, sets the terms of every contract in an illegal off exchange situation could not be a futures contract. And that's simply not the law of this circuit.
It's possible that these customers could actually take possession of the foreign currencies they purchased.
That it was.
It is right. Yes.
The contract term. Yes, there is a contract term.
Then why should it matter to the futures versus spot analysis that no customer chose to take possession?
Because there was no contractual obligation to take the currency.
So what?
That's all the difference in the world, because one has no obligation to take the currency, one may speculate on the price without having an interest in the underlying commodity, the underlying currency. And in fact,
I don't know what it means to say there's an obligation to take delivery. If I contract for the construction of a house, I don't have an obligation to take delivery of the house. I can either sell it to somebody else, or indeed I might be able to sell it back to the developer.
Or you,
by your understanding, it sounds like I've bought myself a futures contract.
No, or you can be held in breach, but you may have a spot contract if you actually have an interest in the purchase of the subject matter of the contract. However, where your counterparty has no enforceable right, if you choose not to take delivery or complete your contractual obligation, because you have a right to offset, enter a closing position, and get out of your contract, you have established that one does not have an interest in the underlying commodity, one has an interest in the price change of that commodity over time.
They received a book entry on their account on the day they bought the currency, and they could demand delivery if they wanted to.
But they were not, yes, which is true of futures contracts, which is true of on-exchange futures trading. However, they also had a right to offset, that is, not to take that delivery. And that, this court in Nagel viewed as a hallmark of a futures trading. We'd also refer the court to the Dunn decision. decision in the Supreme Court where the court rejected the commission's argument by juxtaposing that concept of delivery of a futures contract to the to a spot contract, defining a futures contract as a contract where no currency changes hands at the time of contract formation. A spot contract, by contrast, does imply and anticipate immediate or near-term delivery of the commodity or currency, which was true in Dunn as well as true here. That ability not to take delivery is, in fact, a hallmark of futures trading, as historically recognized and adopted in this circuit as well as in the Supreme Court and every circuit that entertained this question. And the right of offset is, in fact, a fundamental right that changes the nature of a spot arrangement, so one need not rely simply upon the completion of the contract or contract remedies of breach, but rather have contract right not to be interested in the underlying commodity, the subject matter of the contract. And that question of general, what is the purpose of the contract, is a uniform analysis throughout the circuits, in this circuit and in the Supreme Court and in the Commission's case law, for consideration of what is a futures contract. Here, the contract had elements of futurity. That is, the very contract itself defined the transaction as the opening of a position for settlement and for delivery in the future. Contracts were not purchases. They were defined as open positions to be matched by offsetting or closing positions. There was an express provision of the contract concerning novation, or on contractual agreement to match offsetting positions, and the only dollar prices at stake were defined in the contract in its glossary as the determination of the realized profit or loss of the change in price over time. Again, no customer put forward full value of the notional value of the transaction, and no customer was ever obligated to do so. In fact, the contract term provided they could trade at upon 2% of the underlying of the notional amount. And again, as I said, the minimum value of the transactions were not denominated as $100,000, yet customers traded at multiple contracts for their investment in the ranges of $5,000 to $10,000. There was no obligation to ever pay full value here. I just reiterate several points that there was never any contractual obligation to take ownership. And it's Section 9 of the Customer Agreement that provided for delivery.
Do you think it's appropriate to characterize these facts by saying that the buyers, the customers, had a contractual right to compel Aileron to close their positions by offset?
That was the position, that is the affidavit of Mr. Ramon. Under the contract agreement,
you can tell this by reading the contract. What did the contract say?
The contract provided that absent direction from the customer, Aileron could elect offset rollover, adding 2 days to whatever the delivery time was reported to be, but it couldn't make delivery unless the customer provided delivery instructions.
My question is, suppose the customer goes to Aileron and says, I want you to close this position by offset. I want to buy another contract that is equal and opposite to this one. We'll settle in cash. And Aileron says, no, we've decided not to do that today. Would that violate the customer's rights under the contract?
Yes.
Okay, and which clause would it violate?
It would violate multiple clauses read together, but it would involve the Section 9, the delivery rollover offset provision of the contract. It would violate Section 8, the novation of matching terms provision. It would violate Section 5.2, I believe, of the customer agreement, which provides that Aileron would accept bid or ask prices as offered by, as requested by their customers. So, yes, absolutely. It violates multiple provisions of the contract. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I would request to reserve the remainder of that time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Manhart. Mr. Early.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin by addressing one of the questions which was raised by the Court, and that is the footnote in the Commission's initial brief regarding the remand request. This Court has determined previously, and particularly in the case of Patrick versus Ford Motor, 8 Fed 3rd, 455, 1993, that when the District Court finds that the matter is fully before it, right for decision, that the District Court should make that decision, and that the party who believes that that decision was in any way, shape, or form premature bears the burden of showing both prejudice and surprise. And on this record, there is nothing which supports either prejudice or surprise. As we cited in our brief to the Court, on numerous occasions, the District Court advised the government that they considered the issuance of a preliminary injunction to be the second most serious matter that a District Court engaged in, second only to sentencing someone to prison. And repeatedly, all the parties involved had advised the Court that we contested jurisdiction, that we did not believe these were futures contracts. Indeed, Aileron FX was not part of the preliminary injunction hearing because it had entered into a stipulation previously, and in that stipulation it was expressly reserved the right to contest jurisdiction, to contest that these transactions were futures contracts. With 9 months of investigation prior to the time the complaint was filed, with 3 months prior to the time the preliminary injunction hearing was held, with 3 days of evidence at a preliminary injunction hearing, this District Court had more than an ample record upon which to make its determination. And in conformity with the requirements of this Court, there's no prejudice, there's no surprise, so the Court properly ruled on the decision and it properly dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, determining that these are not futures contracts. In that process, I would also point out to the Court something that may have gotten lost.
I don't see what this has to do with the Court's jurisdiction. It has to do with the Commission's jurisdiction.
When you say the Court dismissed
for want of jurisdiction, I assume what you mean is it dismissed because it held the Commission had no authority.
The District Court dismissed, confessing that there was some ambiguity, if you would, in terms of its reasoning, that it wasn't certain whether it was dismissing because the CFTC had no jurisdiction or because the CFTC had no jurisdiction, the Court had no jurisdiction to entertain the case.
What could this possibly have to do with the Court's jurisdiction? This is a lawsuit under 1331. It states a claim arising under federal law, and we've known since Bell against Hood the fact that your claim is no good doesn't mean that the federal court lacks jurisdiction. Say the federal court lacks jurisdiction suggests that what the Commission ought to do next is go and refile this suit in state court. But you don't mean that.
I don't mean that, Your Honor. Absolutely.
You mean that this has been definitively resolved, in your view, that these are not futures.
Correct.
Yes, so the federal court has jurisdiction. So you don't want this lawsuit refiled.
Correct. Absolutely, Your Honor. Now, the other aspect which we were concerned about based on the...
Okay, let me ask you the question that I asked of the CFTC, the factual question. If one of the customers goes to Aileron and says, I demand that you close my position by selling me an offset, does Aileron have to do that?
No. Aileron is making a market to its customers. And
so you say the provision in the contract, Section 9 principally, is an option on Aileron's part rather than an option on the customer's part?
And I don't believe there's any option, Your Honor. I believe that what transpires here on its face is that the customer purchases a currency. If the customer, like purchasing a share in IBM, chooses to maintain that relationship for 3 days, for 5 days, for 5 months, it continues to do so. If it chooses to take delivery, it specifically has the option to do that under the contract. If it also chooses to offset as a means of ending its speculative intent in the contract, yes, the customer may do so.
My question is not whether it may do so, but whether it has, under the contract, a legal entitlement to do so.
No.
The reason I'm asking this is because we said in our Nagel opinion, the one difference between the District Court's Nagel opinion and the Court of Appeals' Nagel opinion is the Court of Appeals' legal opinion has a proviso, number one, in their bulleted list, that if there's a legal entitlement to close by offset, then even a non-fungible contract can be a future. And so that's what I'm trying to pin down. There's a non-fungible contract under the district court's Nagel opinion, can't be a future. Under the Court of Appeals' Nagel opinion, under this court's Nagel opinion, it can be if there's a legal entitlement to close by offset. And it does seem to me we need to pin this down one way or the other.
There is
they say absolutely positively yes. You say absolutely positively no.
Correct.
Maybe that suggests we need more discovery. Either that or we need to read the contract more carefully.
Your Honor, I don't think that there's anything to be gained by more discovery. I think the contract's plain on its face. It says that AFX...
The contract is plain on its face. That's the one thing the two of you agree on. The contract is plain on its face, totally unambiguous. Nobody could disagree about the answer to this question. You just
Your Honor,
agree
I think
on what its answer is.
I think the disagreement comes when one starts to go from one realm of the definition of what constitutes a future to another. And if we migrate from the realm of what is a futures contract, what is a contract for future delivery under the Act, into the murky realm of what constitutes what's admittedly a contract for future delivery, but is exempt from the Act, i.e. a forward contract analysis, then we can get mired down in these distinctions. But I think this court in CME versus SEC set forth a criteria, a definition, for what constitutes a futures contract. And when you analyze that...
I think you may remember that its language says a futures contract roughly is X.
Correct.
It was not an attempt to be definitive.
Correct.
Nagel is an attempt to be definitive. One wants to look at our most recent decision, which actually attempted to answer this question in a case where it mattered.
And I certainly agree with
and
Your
Nagel
Honor.
Nagel gave the answer that it has to be either fungible or, if not fungible, closable by offset.
Well, Nagel...
So that does seem to me where we need to focus our attention.
Nagel also talked, Your Honor, about whether or not there's trading in a contract, or whether or not...
Yes, that's what the fungibility is.
Yes.
If one trades in the contract, that supposes a fungible contract, this is not fungible. That's why, under the district court's opinion in Nagel, this is not a futures contract. That leaves Proviso 1 in the Court of Appeals' opinion. That's where I'm trying to pin things down, and on which the two of you agree that this is completely clear, but you don't agree on what the answer is.
Correct. And Your Honor, the only thing that I would add to that is that Your Honor points out that in the CME decision, the word roughly is used, and it's used to preserve the fact...
Deliberately.
It's used to preserve the fact that each of these transactions must be viewed in their precise factual context.
No.
That there is no bright line.
Not what it's for.
But nonetheless, Your Honor, if we focus solely on one aspect of the transaction, we lose sight of the whole transaction. And I submit when you go back and you look at whether it's the rough definition of the CME case or Co-Petro or any other well-reasoned decision, including Nagel, if you look at what is in these contracts...
I don't know why you want to describe Co-Petro as well-reasoned. That's the CFTC's best authority and a decision that's been... critiqued in this circuit as being flabby and not in accord with the statute.
The reason I say it's well reasoned, Your Honor, is because 30 years ago when it was entered, it served as a distinction between what is a forward contract and what is a futures contract. That's not what's at issue here. But it did take an approach which says you can't look at just any one issue. You can't fixate on any one thing. And when you kick off the list, and I would submit that this court has properly given a list, rough or otherwise, in CME versus SEC.
Exactly. This court and the Ninth Circuit's opinions are almost impossible to reconcile. You cannot live in a world in which both Nagel and Co-Petro exist. We live, fortunately, I'm inclined to think, in the world of Nagel. Why you might want to endorse Co-Petro is beyond my understanding.
Your Honor,
you endorse Co-Petro, you lose.
I endorse the concept that we don't fixate on any one aspect of the transaction. And
you lose. If that's the standard, you lose.
Well, Your Honor, I don't endorse Co-Petro's control in this case, and I haven't...
The agency's view, if reasonable, prevails. See the EPA in the last case. So if it's a flabby, open-ended, no one standard matters, you lose. I don't know why you're so reluctant to argue this circuit's law.
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm trying to come to the CME decision. And
which is not this circuit's law.
Well, in
Correspondence. The stock exchange opinion did not come to closure on this question deliberately. Nagel did. Why don't we talk about Nagel?
Well, my only problem with Nagel is that it came up in the context of the forward contract exemption, which, again, Your Honor, is a totally different construct.
No exemption question in Nagel. The question in both the district court and the Court of Appeals' opinion in Nagel was whether that contract was a futures contract at all.
And, Your Honor, I think you quite properly have focused on the aspect of fungibility. And in the aspect of fungibility, there is a necessity for trading in a contract. Here you have no trading in a contract. You have an instance where customers purchased a foreign currency. Title passed when they made that transaction. Their account was posted with the U.S. dollar equivalent when they made that transaction. Delivery occurred by any rational definition of the term delivery. By the CFTC's own...
No delivery in this case. My goodness, we are talking even the same language. No more delivery in this case than when you buy a Standard & Poor's 500 futures contract on the Board of Trade. You don't get 500 stocks. You get a financial interest, which may or may not be closed by offset.
I agree, Your Honor. Delivery should, but unfortunately, delivery was a large part of the briefings and commissions, so we're in agreement on that. With respect to one other point, Your Honor, and that is that the context in which we come to the appellate court, we agree that the context is de novo review of this court. However, by the court's own previous decisions, specifically Anthony versus Security Pacific, 75 Fed 3rd, 311, with respect to factual issues, you review for abuse of discretion standard. And the district court here expressly in its opinions found Mr. Hobson's affidavits to be unpersuasive. And that's the context in which it comes before this court. And so I believe there's an abuse of discretion requirement before this court to overturn the district court's proper finding in that regard. Again, Your Honor, when you analyze the case under the definitional context, the transactions here do not meet the requirements of future. There's no trading in the contract. There's no clearinghouse present. None of the common elements of futurity are here. And delivery occurs when the transaction takes place. Title passes when the transaction takes place. There is no futurity in the transaction. And on that basis, you should affirm the district court's opinion, and there is no requirement for remand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Early. Anything further, Mr. Manhart?
Just one point, Your Honor. Concerning Nagel, it's focused upon fungibility. It's based upon the nature of whether there are idiosyncratic terms which render the contract fungible or not fungible, and then goes on, citing Copetro, to focus on that issue of offset. Here there was an absolute contractual right for offset in the very same contractual provision that specified the possibility
of... Well, we're going to have to figure out who is right about this.
Yes, Your Honor, and I prefer the court to...
Looks like this boils down to a contract case in the end.
Well, these are contracts. It certainly is. I mean, and as a matter of contract law, it does turn on, in this context, the interpretation of contracts, as well as in every other circumstance, contract on occasion.
Would you tell me what language you think is most favorable to your view that closing by offset is a legal entitlement of the customer rather than an option of Aileron?
There are several provisions, and it's a difficult to read. It's a very complex agreement. But paragraph 5.3 on page 156 of appendix 2 states that Aileron FX will attempt to execute all orders that it may in its sole discretion accept from customer in accordance with the customer's instructions received through the trading system. Paragraph 8, I won't read the whole thing, but concerns novation, that is matching of opposing positions. And which I think also establishes their obligations.
Okay.
Thereafter, paragraph
9. You're relying on 5.3, 8, and 9, principally.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. As well as the reading of the glossary terms of open position, closed position, realized profit and loss,
and
the very term of contract.
We'll the contract and see what it says to us.
Yeah, we would greatly appreciate that, Your Honor. We respectfully request that the court reverse the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Manhart. Thank you, Mr. Early. The case is taken under advisement.